A poem is a snapshot in time, a personal reflection of an event, an emotion, an expression of joy or sorrow, words that may endure for ages. I'm David James, and next on 2 Main Street, my conversation with Indiana Poet Laureate Matthew Graham. The retired University of Southern Indiana professor is serving a 2-year term as Poet Laureate. What does a Poet Laureate do? How has COVID-19 affected the creative process? And why is poetry so important to our culture? And Matthew Graham will share several readings for us, including his snapshot in time when he first arrived in the Evansville area, and his take on the iconic couple Dick and Jane from our childhood. 2 Main Street is next, presented by Jeffrey Berger of Berger Wealth Services at Bayard Private Wealth Management. From the WNIN Public Media Center in downtown Evansville, I'm David James, and this is 2 Main Street. So let's start out with a dad joke. You're a poet and you don't know it, but your feet show it because they're Longfellows. I admit, not the classiest way to introduce my guest, who is Indiana's Poet Laureate, but he has a good sense of humor, as we hear later when he recites his poem, Dick and Jane. But first, here's my take on the craft of poetry, and I may be critiqued on this. Through the careful selection of words and with the cadence and rhythm of a musical score, a poet goes to work, sharing a highly personal view of time and place, kind of a snapshot. The result, hopefully, a literary expression of emotion from joy to utter despair. This could be a simple nursery rhyme, a bawdy limerick, or a solemn dirge to the war dead. Indiana has been celebrating its Hoosier poets with the unofficial title of State Poet Laureate since 1929. Decades later, in 2005, Senate Act 433 created the official Indiana State Poet Laureate, selected by the Indiana Arts Commission, and it's a 2-year term. And the current Indiana Poet Laureate is Matthew Graham, recently retired from the University of Southern Indiana, the author of 4 books on poetry, the most recent, The Geography of Home. Matthew Graham co-founded the Rope Walk Writers Retreat in New Harmony, Indiana, and has been collaborating with the Indiana Humanities Commission, exploring the themes of protest and pandemic with fellow Hoosier poets. So after that ponderous introduction, Matthew Graham, welcome to 2 Main Street. Good to have you here.
Well, thank you. It's a pleasure and an honor to be here.
So how has the pandemic, has it inspired you to create, Matthew? or just the opposite?
I don't know. I mean, it's been a very strange year for everyone. And I don't know. Not really. I've been doing some work. A lot of the plans I had as Poet Laureate have been put on hold, of course. In terms of my own work, I haven't felt that inspired. I feel like these are serious times, but I just feel kind of creatively numb to it all somehow. It's hard
kind
to
of
explain.
A malaise, you think?
Yeah, that might be a good word. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it might be.
So
everything's
now these,
on hold.
Yeah, these themes of protest and pandemic—that's ponderous as well.
Yeah, well, through the Humanities Council, I was able to do a couple of little podcasts where I was just asking Indiana writers their opinions on things. I started out last April for National Poetry Month for them to respond to why poetry was important in their lives, and I asked poets and fiction writers around the state for their responses. And then over the summer, of course, with the pandemic kicking in and all the protests, I asked some new questions about how what that meant to them and how that affected them, and to submit some poems concerning those subjects, which they did. And they're all on the website for the Humanities Council, and I think I've got some really interesting and important responses. And I'm starting a new one this week, which I'm going to be focusing on Amanda Gorman's poem, the inaugural poem, The Hill We Climb. And I want to ask Indiana writers what they feel about the poem in terms of how it might have revitalized American poetry, what it means to American poetry, what she wrote, and what it means to our nation.
Well, she's of course the young lady who gained national attention with her inaugural poem, and even what she was wearing was also
I think she got
viral.
a modeling contract.
Yeah, she did, definitely. So now I looked up the duties of the Indiana Poet Laureate, and they include visiting schools, including the state schools for the deaf and the blind, libraries, also offering advice on ways to further the art of poetry in the state, and representing Indiana and the art of poetry to educate the public. And so you're doing that right now.
Oh, I'm trying to do it right now. Like I said, it's been terrible. I mean, all these plans I had are just on hold. I mean, I plan on visiting all 92 counties in the state, all the different arts councils across the state. I've contacted them all at the very beginning of my tenure to see what they would like me to do, whether it be give talks, readings, judge contests, teach classes. And obviously, I haven't been able to do any of that stuff physically. So I've been doing a lot on Zoom. I've been trying to do as much as I can. I've been teaching some classes, giving interviews, talking to classes. It's not as much as I wanted to do, but it's been something, at least.
So really, you have lost a year of your two-year term.
Lost. You lost quite a bit of it, yeah. Mm-hmm.
So we were talking, maybe you'll get an extension here. Well. Maybe we can explore that.
Yeah, let's see. I mean, I'd love to if they're willing to consider it. You
know. So let's learn more about the Indiana Poet Laureate, Matthew Graham. Where did you grow up, Matthew?
I grew up in the Catskill Mountains of upstate New York.
So how did you make your way to southern Indiana?
It was a long process. To make a very long story short, I had never considered teaching as a career. But I ended up teaching as a year replacement at the University of Missouri. And I enjoyed it so much, I thought, well, maybe I should pursue this as a career. Because up to then, that point, my career was basically blue-collar work. So I looked around for places that were hiring, and I sent out my resume, and I was interviewed here at USI and got the job.
So what did you want to do besides teaching?
I didn't really have any big careers in mind. I wanted to write, and I always had kind of working-class jobs. I felt most comfortable doing that. I never felt comfortable in an office job. So I never had any big career, you know, prospects.
What did you study in college then?
Well, I was a literature major as an undergraduate, and then in graduate school I studied.
Where'd you go to school?
I went to the State University of New York at Binghamton, and then I got my master's from Johns Hopkins and my master's of fine arts from Iowa, from the Writer's Workshop there. But I wasn't getting an education necessarily to get a better job. I wanted to learn stuff, and I wanted to learn how to become a writer, and that's pretty much why I went to school.
So fiction or?
I studied poetry primarily.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. Yeah. Now, were you writing poems in college?
I started to. I think I probably started writing in high school, but I think I was probably writing song lyrics, you know,
sure.
Which were very interesting to me in those days. I didn't quite understand what poetry really was until I got to college. And I took one creative writing class in college, which really made me consider this something I might want to do. But it was so interesting. I was so stupid. I didn't realize when I was in college that there were any living poets. I thought they were all dead. Mm-hmm. I thought maybe Robert Frost was the last one.
The Dead Poets Society.
Right. And then I discovered there were living, working poets, and I read them, and some of them just knocked me out. And I thought, wow. You know, two poets in particular, well, one poet in particular was Phil Levine, who just died a couple of years ago, but he was this working-class Jewish character out of Detroit who worked in the car factories and wrote about it and wrote about the people he worked with. And he had great respect for working-class people and their lives. And I read that stuff, and I said, you can write about this? You know, it's not all clouds and daffodils. You can write about real people doing real things, about things I understood. And so that turned me around. It really did. But a funny story is when I got into grad school at Johns Hopkins, I called my dad up to tell him I was moving to Baltimore, and again, he's kind of, he was a working class guy, and I was surprised he even knew this, but he said, what are you going to study? And I said, poetry. And there was a big pause.
I bet.
And then he said, isn't there a medical school there? Because he thought, you know, if I got into grad school, I could just move over to surgery, you know?
Sure.
I'm in. And so that explained to him it didn't work that way. But
we're talking to Matthew Graham. He's Indiana's poet laureate, serving a two-year term. Hopefully we're trying to get him another term because of the pandemic. Now, you showed me a couple of your books, and the book's covers include artwork by your wife, Katie.
Uh-huh.
How did you guys meet?
Katie Waters. Well, we met at USI.
Really?
Right. She was here a couple of years before I arrived, and we served on a committee together. And then the rest is history.
Was she a professor there?
Yeah, professor of art. She was mm-hmm. the chair of the art department for a long time, and then she was an administrator in liberal arts for a while. And she retired. We both retired a year ago.
Mm-hmm. So. Now, you have a poem that you wrote when you first arrived in Evansville. It's titled simply Indiana.
Yes.
And would you like to share that
sure.
with us?
Absolutely.
Well, as he looks that up, we're talking to Matthew Graham, Indiana's poet laureate. And what year would that have been when you...
1984.
Okay. And you talk about kind of the history of the Evansville area. I know the shipyard is in there, too.
Yeah, well, this was... of course, this poem is 35 years old, and things have changed considerably in Evansville, but this is how it looked to me 35 years ago. I'd first moved here. I'd been here a couple months. I didn't know much about Evansville. Did some research, did some snooping around, and came up with this poem. It's called Indiana, but if you're from here, you'll recognize the town. In the town where I live, women once built P-47s, in the same factories where men now build washing machines. I guess you could say it's a town of some irony. Yet the smell of war effort is still strong here. Not far downriver from the moored, fake, stern-wheeled party boat are the sunken dry docks where they riveted together LSTs for Normandy. And the bus station still breaks my heart. All late 30s science fiction. It touched down in a hum of neon, and everyone got off, rolled up their sleeves, and went to work. I took a bus from there once for $50. And if you could blot out the video games, you'd almost believe you were AWOL or heading for some genuine horror in the South Pacific. It's a funny town. I don't mean it's a place time forgot, just a place that has evacuated itself from time. It doesn't take responsibility for its own history, and maybe they need to build a monument or something to commemorate what happened to outdated aircraft and all the dead boys who flew them. We know what happened to the women who built the planes. They're doing the wash, or their daughters are. I watched them carefully in the laundromats, talking and laughing, sorting the colors from the whites, while behind us, the sky goes off forever.
So, what inspired you to write that?
I was just getting a sense of the town and of the place, and I guess I was just trying to capture the conflicting feelings I felt here about it, about its history and its place and time now. Of course, so many of those things have changed, mm-hmm. and for the better, I think, in many ways. I think it's a much more exciting town than it was 35 years ago.
So what are you working on now?
Now I am working on, slowly, a number of things. I've started a series called the Indiana Series, where I am taking lines or sentences from Indiana writers and building a poem from them. But I'm using people that are not quite as well-known any longer as, say, somebody like Kurt Vonnegut. Indiana's got an incredibly rich history of writers. So some of the people I'm working with is Ross Lockridge, who wrote Raintree County, Marguerite Young, who wrote Angel in the Forest, and Ernie Pyle, of course, who, mm-hmm. who wrote so many incredible dispatches from the front.
So you're taking lines from those existing poems, reworking
yes,
them?
Yes, right.
Or?
And I could share one with
sure,
you if
yeah.
you'd like. It's a small one. This is from the Indiana series, and this is called Beginning with a Line from Ernie Pyle. And the line is, "And yet you know, always in your heart, you have never really left." When Ernie Pyle walked the high tide line of Omaha Beach the morning after D-Day, of all that he stepped over, what he remembered most were the cartons of soggy cigarettes, stationery, French phrase books, sewing kits, snapshots, playing cards, metal pocket mirrors, a tennis racket still clamped in its rack, a broken banjo. Seabirds circled, what history brings, what history leaves behind.
Well, that conjures up a lot of images, of course. And the tennis racket, that somebody would actually bring a tennis racket during an invasion.
Yeah, I took this, the information from an article he wrote about the morning after when he walked along the beach. And, of course, there was a lot of awful things he saw. But it was those details from just the oddness. I mean, who would take a banjo onto Normandy or a tennis racket? What do they think there would be? You know, playing tennis.
No, that's interesting. My father, he landed on Omaha Beach, but I think it was like day two or day three after they had probably cleaned up a lot of that debris and everything. Yeah. But yeah, it's that's really a lot of images there. My guest is Indiana poet laureate Matthew Graham. Now, coming up, some more readings, including, well, we lighten things up with the poem Dick and Jane, which apparently was a big crowd pleaser at the Lincoln Amphitheater. Also, why poets and other artists find inspiration and solace in the small community of New Harmony. And we'll go over some of my college textbook notes on Walt Whitman. Will I make the grade? We'll find out. Two Main Street is presented by Jeffrey Berger of Berger Wealth Services at Bayard Private Wealth Management. We'll be right back. In doing research for this interview, I came across another intriguing Hoosier poet, Susan Wallace. She was the wife of Lew Wallace, a major general in the Civil War, and a celebrated author. His most famous work, Ben-Hur, The Tale of the Christ. Susan Wallace was a published author long before her husband's literary fame. Her early poems were about children, flowers, romance, and lives cut short. During and after the Civil War, a more serious tone, as she continued to chronicle women and their situation in life. Here's an excerpt from Susan Wallace's poem, Divorced, written in 1868. In the leaves of a forgotten book lay a withered flower, where it had lain ever since the night he unloosed it from her hair, and whispered words of love and hope as they sat close together, in the bloom of the lost old times, in the golden summer weather. Then the love, so cold it seemed dead, cried out and uncovered its face, and tears fell fast on the faded rose as she laid it back in its place. The lost old time and the dear old love, she believed forever dead, came back again, and the red rose bloomed once more in her girlish head. For the sake of love stronger than death, for the sake of that golden hour, one poor last kiss she softly laid on the dust of the poor dead flower. Then she tried to still her love to rest and to hush its bitter cry, but it breathed and moved and mourned, for she could not make it die. Welcome back to Two Main Street. I'm David James. My guest is Matthew Graham of Evansville, who is Indiana's Poet Laureate. Now, obviously, a Poet Laureate wants to share his or her love of literature and poetry with fellow Hoosiers. And, of course, you start early in the classroom. So, Matthew, how do you trigger students' interest in poetry? Do they read it out loud, or how do you do that?
Well, of course, in my advanced classes, students came to me because they already had an interest in poetry. But in my Intro to Creative Writing class, I would teach poetry and fiction. And most of the kids in those classes were much more interested in fiction. But I started out with poetry, trying to teach them that they get the sense of poetry down, understand the rhythm of the language and the preciseness of detail. It would only add to their fiction. Right, and so that's how I'd hook them. And then I'd show them that how much could be done in a short amount of time in a poem, and I think that always kind of really really interests people. You know, this the way you can distill language down to its really powerful essence, and I think after a while, most students would come around to most students that were only interested in fiction came around to poetry.
I think it's when you look at a poem, and you look at the words and everything, and then you try to read it and listen to it. There's a difference there.
Yeah.
And of course, a person reading the poetry, if they have a lot of power and everything, that really brings that poem to life.
Sure, sure, absolutely. And I've heard pretty bad poems be recited incredibly well. And also I've heard some really famous poets destroy their own poetry when they read it. So I think it's important to hear it, certainly, because it's an oral tradition,
sure.
Originally, you know, from the troubadours. But also I like to see it on the page as well, because I can go back over it again and mm-hmm. you know.
I was interested. I was doing some research in that in the 19th century, poetry readings was a kind of a popular social deal, and these poets would travel to different towns and,
sure.
and they'd gather people together, and that's how they would make an income.
Yeah, and poets and fiction writers. I think it was Charles Dickens did a huge tour of the United States in the 19th century and pretty much made a fortune doing
sure,
it. You know?
Yeah.
But it's amazing how many people would come out mm-hmm. for a reading and pay money for it.
Now, tell us about the Rope Walk Writers Retreat in New Harmony. Rope Walk, I found out, was the title of a poem by Henry Wadsworth Longfellow.
Right. Well, my colleague and friend and mentor, Tom Wilhelmus from USI, and I, when I first got there, David Rice, the then president, we had taken over some of the management of New Harmony. He took a bunch of us out there and said, why don't you think about what you'd like to do out here? And so Tom and I thought this would be a wonderful place for a writers' conference. And so we started the Rope Walk Conference. Tom came up with the name, not so much from that poem, but from there is an actual rope walk in New Harmony. It's where the harmonists would stretch out the hemp that they grew and twine it into ropes. And we thought, that's a wonderful metaphor, you know.
Sure it is.
And so we started the conference. It was a week-long conference in the summer. We'd bring in nationally known writers that would teach classes and give readings and craft lectures. People came from all over the country. And we did that for 22 summers, mm-hmm. so quite a while.
And New Harmony is a special place. I saw one interview you had where the matriarch of New Harmony, Jane Owen,
mm-hmm.
Read one of your poems and took issue maybe with some of your words describing the town of New Harmony, that you kind of said it was mysterious and strange and had kind of an aura of maybe
darkness.
Yeah, darkness to it. And but, you know, I kind of get that same vibe when I go to New Harmony.
Mm-hmm.
There's a mystery there.
Absolutely.
I mean, two societies, kind of a unique people that wanted to start just societies there. They didn't quite make it. But there's, I guess, maybe there's some ghosts there. I don't know.
No, I think you're right. I think it's definitely haunted.
Sure.
But in a pleasant way.
Sure.
Yeah, right.
It's not frightening.
No.
But it's strange.
Right. Well, people love going to the conference, and writers love being there. And we also allowed people time just to write while mm-hmm. they were there, which was helpful, I think. So.
Mm-hmm. Now, we were talking about some famous poets. James Whitcomb Riley, Indiana's poet, and America's poet is Walt Whitman.
Right.
And James Whitcomb Riley, you know, I really didn't learn a whole lot about him when I was studying poetry, but a fascinating guy. Of course, he's known for The Raggedy Man and Little Orphan Annie.
Absolutely.
And
right.
He was, very popular during his writing time.
He also did those huge public readings.
Yes, right.
Yeah.
And, of course, Riley Hospital's named after
sure.
him. He was really a state hero.
Yeah.
And now, Walt Whitman, I know you've studied Walt Whitman. Didn't
mm-hmm.
you do some research on him?
Yeah. In this new book, I've got a poem where I take this kind of imaginary walk with him.
Yeah. Yeah. We'll talk about that later.
Sure.
Now, I did receive a request from Scott Solomon, who was a previous guest on 2 Main Street, and he is the force behind the Will Read and Sing for Food concerts,
right.
which, and I've seen some video of those. They're pretty freewheeling, I would say.
Yes, but a lot of fun.
Yeah, they're kind of structured, everybody just kind of has a good time. And he wanted me to ask you to read your poem, Dick and Jane, which he says brought down the house at the Lincoln Amphitheater. I don't know if he was exaggerating or not.
I think he was.
Do you have that handy?
I do.
Dick and Jane?
I think it brought down the house because it was an old house. you have to be a certain age to remember who Dick and Jane were. And for your listeners who are not of that age, they were characters in grammar school readers that many of us grew up with. And I think the poem pretty much explains it, who they were and how I felt about them. They were middle-class, suburban white kids, and we followed their lives and learned to read by doing so.
So here's the Indiana Poet Laureate, Matthew Graham, reading Dick and Jane.
Dick and Jane. Oh, how I hated their precious pets and perfect parents, their goody two-shoed lives balanced on the footbridge of white bread and moral smugness. But they taught me to read, taught me to live. And then they vanished from the public eye in 1965, aged 10 and 8. They'd be in their late 50s, early 60s by now, and I hope it was a rocky ride of rehab and therapy. But it wasn't, really. Jane's first marriage was short and terrible, but her second was happy. She's a retired nurse practitioner with three loving grandchildren. Dick still works as an insurance adjuster and is a closeted member of the school board. Isn't it funny how in some ways we were never children and in other ways we always are? But they taught me to read. They taught me to see. See the weary light on the lawn of late summer. See the years rise like ash into a starless sky. See Spot run.
So that's what happened to Dick and Jane.
I hope so. But also, Spot was one of their pets.
Well, definitely.
That
yeah,
was
I remember
the dog.
Spot. That's right.
Yeah.
Spot was very popular, definitely. Now, we were talking about younger poets and inspiring even more poets. And the young poet who stole the show at the inauguration was Amanda Gorman.
Yes.
And you know much about her?
I didn't. Really, and until, of course, you know, she became so famous with that poem, and then I read a lot about her. But I didn't know much about her ahead of time at all. You know, The Hill We Climb, I just thought it was just a breathtaking poem. And her performance, her professionalism, the whole thing was just stunning.
Yeah, her age with that just, the world watching her, really.
I don't know how she did it. I really don't. But it was such a wise poem, and I think it showed us that poetry can be social and political, and also it can be healing. I remember at one point she talks about trying to stop history, not change history, but stop it, meaning I think what she meant was not to allow certain things that have happen again. That was an incredibly insightful poem.
Now, you succeeded Adrian, is it
Matika.
Matika, in the post of State Laureate. And tell us about him.
Well, he's a great poet. he's a great guy. I haven't been in touch with him in a while. I saw him in Indianapolis actually a year ago. We were both judging a national high school contest, not national, state high school contest. So I haven't been much in touch with him. I know he's working on some new stuff, and
he's at IU. Is that
yes? Yeah. And but Indiana, there are. I mean, I'm really honored to be poet laureate because there are so many great poets in this state. Like I was saying earlier, we have incredible history of writers, but there's still so many here. I think part of the reason might be we have so many great universities in this state, and that draws good writers.
Now, tell us about the selection process of the Indiana State Poet Laureate. How does that go about? What's involved?
Well, as far as I know, I was nominated. I made a short list, and then I was told I had it. So, and I was, of course, honored, but also a little shocked, as I said, given the caliber of people we have here.
Now, will you be involved in selecting your successor?
That's a really good question. I don't know. I really don't know.
You'd think that you might have some
Yeah,
input.
I mean, I'd like to be.
Definitely.
I really would, yeah.
So you have others that are waiting in the wings, I'm sure, that are worthy of that title.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, gosh, there are so many, not only poets, but just, like I keep saying, writers in Indiana. I'm always astounded. Morris Stanton and Ross Gay and Marion Brooke. I mean, these are just a couple of incredible poets.
Mm-hmm. You know. Now, of course, during the pandemic, we've talked about maybe it's kind of a malaise until we get this all started, settled. You've been reading a lot during this time?
Yes, I've been reading constantly. I mean, I read a lot anyway, but this has certainly been a nice time to get caught up.
Who have you been reading?
Well, I knew you were going to ask me that, and I'm going to draw a blank. I just read the history of oysters in New York, believe it or not. I don't know, so much stuff. I've been reading some poets I haven't read in a long time. I've been just catching up. My wife and I, we get The New Yorker, The Atlantic, and Harper's, and that alone is a pile of reading
sure.
to do. And the Sunday Times, and just keeping up on all that stuff has been great. But going back, the poet Jarrell, I've been reading some of his stuff, some of his criticism and essays from the 50s. I'm not reading so much new stuff, but just trying to catch up on some old stuff I haven't read in a long time.
Well, I think it's important to reread.
Yeah, because you see it differently.
Oh, you do. You really
do. At different ages.
And a different time in your life, too.
Absolutely, yeah.
You'll kind of understand, okay, that's what they meant by that.
right. I didn't get it that time.
Sure, definitely. Right. Well, coming up, Matthew Graham reviews some of my college homework on poet Walt Whitman. Also, we'll hear about a trip to Ireland, that's right?
Yes.
Okay, that's good. Studying the Gaelic
yes.
language, that's mm-hmm. fascinating. And we'll have some other readings from my guest, Indiana Poet Laureate Matthew Graham. I'm David James. This is 2 Main Street, presented by Jeffrey Berger of Berger Wealth Services at Bayard Private Wealth Management. Indiana has a rich literary history, including many African-American writers, playwrights, and poets. Among them is Marie Evans. She died in 2017, living 70 of her 97 years in Indiana. She's remembered as one of the founders of the Black Arts Movement. Her poem, I Am a Black Woman, published in 1970, won the Black Academy of Arts and Letters Poetry Award. In one of her last interviews, Marie Evans reflected on her life's work, saying, "All I ever really wanted to do is speak the truth, and I really don't care what people think." Here's her poem, Rebel. When I die, I'm sure I will have a big funeral. Curiosity seekers coming to see if I am really dead or just trying to make trouble. Indiana poet Marie Evans. Welcome back to 2 Main Street. I'm David James. If you are just joining us, my guest is Matthew Graham, retired University of Southern Indiana professor, author of 4 books on poetry, and the current Indiana Poet Laureate. Now, I understand you've been doing some more reading than writing, but when you do write, what's your routine, Matthew? Is there a certain time of day you like to write?
Oh, gosh. You know, I'd like to say there was, you know, but no, not really. I mean, I'm a very slow writer. I usually have something kicking around in my head for a long time before I even commit it to paper.
Mm-hmm.
So usually when I've had a lot of time now. Sometimes too much time can be detrimental, you know.
Sure.
Sometimes when I don't have time, I'll squeeze in an hour and actually get more done than if I have a whole day.
Deadlines are important, I think.
Yes, absolutely. They really are.
They motivate.
Yeah, sure, of course.
Now, do you have pots of coffee on hand?
Or, yes.
Oh, you do?
Of course,
okay.
Yes.
That's important.
Right.
That's important. Okay. Now, we were talking about this trip to Ireland, a special project studying the Gaelic language. Tell me about that, Matthew Graham.
Well, when I was working on this new book, The Geography of Home, I was considering and exploring all the different aspects of what home means, you know, where one's lived and places that have been important, but also psychologically, the past itself being kind of a home you can return to. And I was also thinking of ancestral homes and being Irish-American, Scottish-Irish-American. I thought I needed to know more about where I came from. And so the University of USI was generous enough to give me a grant to go to Ireland and study Gaelic for part of a summer a couple of years ago, which is probably the most difficult language outside of Hebrew and Arabic that exists. I was not very successful, but it did give me a sense of you know, of where I came from, and that was important. And I was able to write a few things where I could sneak in a few Gaelic words. And
now, did you basically stay in the Dublin area, or did you go out?
Oh no, this was way up in northwestern Ireland, the Donegal area. And really a rugged coastal area, a little town called Glencolumbkeel, and there's a language school there. And people come from all over to study language, to study Gaelic. I was surprised at the popularity of it. A lot of Irish teachers who now have to teach Gaelic, which is good because they were afraid they were losing the language, and linguists and scholars Europeans interested in the language. There's only like two or three places in Ireland called the Gaeltacht where people still actually speak Irish.
Really?
And that's one of them. But it was a fascinating experience, and I met some wonderful people, and some very interesting and sad things about Irish. They have, you know, that myth that Eskimos have like 100 words for snow, and I don't even know if that's true or not, but the Irish do have like 10 different words for goodbye, which is really kind of sad. You know, different versions of
sure.
goodbye,
yeah.
Which I thought was...
Like
was
a goodbye forever.
Goodbye forever, goodbye for now, mm-hmm. goodbye to my town, mm-hmm. all from the root word schlan. So, and yeah, interesting.
Now, the Cliffs of Moher,
uh-huh.
is that near that area?
Nope, the other side of the country.
I'm not
yeah.
getting close yeah. to it, am I?
Yeah, you got to go. It's actually north... It's actually north of Northern Ireland. It's still part of the Republic, but it's curls
really?
Way
oh,
up to
way up
yeah,
there.
Way
okay.
Up, right.
Oh my
yeah.
gosh, yeah.
Yeah.
That
yeah.
really is remote.
It's about a day car journey from Dublin.
Mm-hmm. So the Irish experience, you said you've written some poems from that or essays? Or
yeah, I got a couple of poems out of it. Uh-huh.
Okay.
I did.
Do you have one nearby? Or?
Well, they're really long.
Oh, okay. We'll have to. Is it in a book?
Yeah, it's in the new book.
In the Geography of Home.
Yes,
so
right.
if you want to delve into that,
yeah.
go for it. Now,
I could read the beginning of one.
Would well, sure,
that
yeah.
be helpful?
Let's do that. Since we had that set up.
Sure, of course. I just read the first section of a poem called the Gaeltacht, which is the that area of Ireland.
Okay.
And it begins, Glencolumbkeel, Dun Nana Daga Eri, which translates Valley of the Dove of the Church, Fort of the Strangers, Ireland. One, the language. Brief streaks of sunlit vowels against the porter dark sea of consonants. The language is 5,000 years of farming, of rock walls etched with moss. It's the shadow of a portal tomb burned into a bog. It's the rain, the wind-carved coast, the cries of seabirds drifting over the dean. It waits in the evening at the end of the lane. The language is the parting glass of the night, the heather, the foxglove, the thistle. It's peat smoke, shattered stone farms scattered on the hillsides. It's rusted wire, hinges without gates. It's a coffin ship slipping out of its dark harbor. It's a covered mirror, a stopped clock. The language is a mask worn for the Vikings, Cromwell, famine, the black and tans. The language is a mask that asks, que so, que sin? And so who comes here to this outpost in Donegal, so far beyond the pale, to study this language? Secondary teachers, medieval scholars, linguists, guilty nationalists, Americans looking for a past. In Ireland, emotions are carried like burdens, not internalized. A depressed person has a black pool upon him, Lynn Doob. My classmate, a Catholic from the north, tells me you can tell Catholics from Protestants by the way they say their H's. The language of stealth, of blood, of ghosts, of goodbye, schlan, schlangefall, Shlánawalla.
Well, that is a snapshot of Ireland. If you've been there, you can see it again through those words. Excellent.
Thank you.
Now, I brought along my textbook from the University of Evansville bookstore, $9.95 back in 1970, I think. That was a lot of money back then.
It was.
Well, of course, books now are, who knows how much they're on now. I know they're astronomical. But anyway, I had a lot of notes on Walt Whitman. And I know you've done some studying of Walt Whitman. Of course, Civil War era poet.
Yes.
Fascinating guy.
Yes.
I mean, if you know anything about his biography. America's Poet, of course, Leaves of Grass, Song of Myself, which is really strange. If you get into the Song of Myself, there's some interesting points in there.
Yes.
So tell us about your Whitman research, Matthew Graham.
Oh, gosh. Well... Whitman, of course, and Emily Dickinson are considered the grandpa and grandma of contemporary American poetry. And Whitman was one of the first writers to write in what we call free verse, which was pretty radical at the time, which meant there was no prescribed rhythm or rhyme or meter to his poetry. And it's still with us today. Whitman's such a character because he was... amazingly self-promoting, self-published, and when he worked for the Brooklyn Eagle, he would review his own book under a different name and say it was the best thing that ever happened. The research I did was for a specific poem in my new book where I take this imaginary walk with him through Lower Manhattan in the 1860s during the Civil War. And I was trying to not only capture what the place was like then, but also his cadences and rhythms. And Whitman probably needed an editor. He went on and on and on and on. You know, somebody needed to say, Walt, please, enough. But I wanted to write a poem about him and his time and also to make a connection between that time and our own times, and which I try to do toward the end of the poem. Mm-hmm. But I think the Civil War actually just took the wind out of his sails. If you read some of the poems he wrote during the war and after when he was working as a nurse in Washington and all the death and destruction he saw, I think all the great dreams he had for America and you know, the promise he felt the country had, and I think it got knocked out of him by the Civil War. I think it really changed him.
The assassination of Lincoln really
and that too, of course,
took a toll on him.
Right.
Like when lilacs last in the dooryard bloomed.
Yes.
Whitman called Lincoln the Western Star. And
the Western Star.
Oh, fallen Western Star, he says in one of his lines there. So and there's a lot of like death and despair, too, in that poem.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I think it really clobbered him.
Mm-hmm. Now, I know he talks about there's a lot of transcendency, too, when the body leaving... when you die and when your soul and everything goes into all that. So it's really a trip, though, to read Walt Whitman.
No, I like him kind of the way I like Shakespeare. I like to just dip in and out, you know, find things I really enjoy and think about them for a while.
Emily Dickinson.
Yes.
Tell us about her and your impressions and how she's maybe affected your
I don't think she has, actually. I was never a fan of hers. I mean, her stuff is so odd and strange, and I love it lots of times, and sometimes I don't quite understand what she's trying to do, which is kind of interesting about poetry. Sometimes I like the mystery to it.
Mm-hmm.
I just read a poem recently called Emily Dickinson at the Poetry Slam, where the writer's, you know, he has her at this poetry slam giving a reading, and she just shuts the house down, you know, because she's very shy. It's the first time she's ever left her own house to go out, and it's the last time she ever goes out. And she reads her poems, and just the place collapses. It's a wonderful poem. But I think I was probably more attracted to Whitman, finally. Mm-hmm.
Now, recently we lost Lawrence Ferlinghetti.
Yes.
Kind of the beat poet, wasn't he, described American?
Yeah,
beat
though
poet?
he didn't necessarily like what he didn't really, from what I've read from interviews, he didn't really like being connected with the beats that much. But I mean, he definitely was. I mean, Coney Island of the Mind, his first book, sold over has sold over a million copies. But he was certainly part of that generation, and he started City Lights Books San Francisco and the press, and you know, got Allen Ginsberg published for the first time, and went through all kinds of court cases because of Ginsberg's book Howl.
And he lived to be 101.
Amazing, because most of those guys died pretty young. I mean, you know, like Kerouac, I think, died in his 40s. But yeah, I mean, an amazing person, and so important to contemporary poetry. I mean, his bookstore, he wanted to sell paperback books that were inexpensive and that were of new, interesting, radical poets, and mm-hmm. that's what he did.
Yeah. Now, you have four books, is that correct?
Yes, I do. Uh-huh.
And your latest is Geography of Home.
Yes.
And I wanted to maybe have you share maybe a reading from that, one of your poems.
Sure. Trying to think what would be the best one.
We are talking to Matthew Graham, Indiana's Poet Laureate, and he's been reading some of his works, and his latest book is Geography of Home. And let's see what he's decided to share with us.
Well, I think I'll read the title poem.
Okay, great.
It's not that long.
Okay.
Okay. And it's called the Geography of Home. There's no GPS for the past, no way to get back to those nights spent ceaselessly watching for Sputnik to wander across the eastern sky, or to those days that seem now as delicate as the cellophane wings of dragonflies, helicoptering over the rotting rowboat, sinking in the green shade of a lost lake, or as sudden as the curtain of rain that sometimes swept that lake in late summer, like a boundary between then and the possibility of now. So much lonely time measured in a place of fading light by the arc of barn swallows and the dying blue-black panic of bottle flies stuck to the yellow flypaper hung over the wringer washer on grandmother's back porch.
Your grandmother.
Yeah.
Memories of her? Her back porch.
I remember the back porch. I remember the wringer washer. I remember the flypaper. Do you remember flypaper?
And where was that?
That was in upstate New York, in the Catskills.
Where in upstate New York?
Well, the Catskill Mountains are about 150 miles north of New York City.
Mm-hmm. But a world away.
Oh, my God. Light years away. Well, it was an old, you know, it was a resort area. A lot of old hotels were still there when I was a kid, but also mainly dairy farms. My father bred dairy cows mm-hmm. for a living, and my grandfather was a farmer. And as a kid, you could wash dishes in the hotel and then put in hay for a farmer in the afternoon. And so it was an interesting place.
What was the view from your grandmother's back porch?
That's a good question. By then, they had sold the farm, and they'd moved into town. Outside of town, and there was a garage, a field. Uh-huh. I haven't thought about that view in a long time. But you remember a flypaper, don't you?
Oh, I do remember that. Of course, I remember fly swatters more than flypaper.
I mean, you always bang into it. It gets stuck in your hair.
Oh, true, yes. And a wringer washer, I remember those.
Yeah.
Right. I remember, my grandparents, for a while, they didn't have they had an outhouse when I first...
Gosh.
Memories of going to my grandparents'
right.
house
in
Knox County, Indiana. They
wow.
had an outhouse, and that was a unique experience.
Right. Scary.
Definitely. Outhouses are scary.
Something's going to get you.
Yeah, that's right. You don't know what's down below there. Okay. Well, this has been a lot of fun. Matthew Graham, Indiana's Poet Laureate. Congratulations on that title.
Thank you.
Thanks for sharing your passion for literature and your passion for home, not only here, but your home back in upstate New York. Matthew Graham, thanks for being my guest.
Thank you for having me.
This is 2 Main Street. I'm David James, and 2 Main Street is presented by Jeffrey Berger of Berger Wealth Services at Bayard Private Wealth Management. Indiana's poet James Whitcomb Riley is known for two of his children's poems, The Raggedy Man and Little Orphaned Annie. Little Orphaned Annie was written in 1885, and the first title was The Elf Child. Riley changed the name for the poem's third printing. Riley wrote rhymes in the 19th century Hoosier dialect, and the Annie character in the poem was inspired by an orphan living in the Riley home. The message is clear to children then and now. If you don't behave, there are consequences. Little orphan Annie comes to our house to stay and wash the cups and saucers up and brush the crumbs away and shoo the chickens off the porch and dust the hearth and sweep and make the fire and bake the bread and earn her board and keep. And all us other children, when the supper things is done, we sit around the kitchen fire and has the mostest fun and listen to the witch tales that Annie tells about and the goblins that get you if you don't watch out. And little orphan Annie says when the blaze is blue and the lamp wick sputters and the wind goes woo-woo and you hear the crickets quit and the moon is gray and the lightning bugs in dew is all squinched away, you'd better mind your parents and your teachers fond and dear and cherish them that loves you and dry the orphan's tear and help the poor and needy ones at clusters all about. Here the goblins will get you if you don't watch out. James Whitcomb Riley's Raggedy Man was first published in 1888 and became the inspiration for the Raggedy Ann doll and two Hollywood films. Riley said the poem was inspired by a German tramp employed by his father. Oh, the Raggedy Man, he works for Pa, and he's the goodest man ever you saw. He comes to our house every day and waters the horses and feeds them hay. And he opens the shed and we all just laugh when he drives out our little old wobbly calf. And if our hired girl says he can, he milks the cow for Elizabeth Ann. And ain't he an awful good Raggedy Man? Raggedy, Raggedy, Raggedy Man. Why, the Raggedy Man, he's so good, he splits the kindling and chops the wood. And he spades in our garden, too, and does most things the boys can't do. And clumb clean up our big tree, and shook an apple down for me, and another in two for Elizabeth Ann, and another in two for the Raggedy Man. Ain't he an awful kind Raggedy Man? Raggedy, Raggedy, Raggedy Man? A celebration of Indiana poetry, past and present. I'm David James, and this is Two Main Street.